The work at Sunday Caves was even more interesting than Tara Courtney had expected it to be, and she adapted rapidly to the leisurely pace and life and intellectually stimulating companionship of the small specialist team of which she was now a part. Tara shared a tent with two young students from the University of the Witwatersrand, and she found with mild surprise that the close proximity of other women in such Spartan accommodation did not bother her. They were up long before dawn to escape the heat in the middle of the day, and after a quick and frugal breakfast, Professor Hurst led them up to the site and allocated the day's labours. They rested and ate the main meal at noon. And then, as the day cooled, they returned to the site and worked on until after the light failed. After that, they had only enough energy for a hot shower, a light meal, and the narrow camp beds. The site was in a deep kloof. The rocky sides dropped steeply 200 feet to the narrow riverbed in the gut. The vegetation in the protected and sun-warmed valley was tropical, quite alien to that on the exposed grasslands that was scoured by wind and winter frosts. Tall candelabra aloes grew on the upper slopes, while further down it became even denser, and there were tree ferns and cycads and huge strangler figs with bark like elephant hide, grey and wrinkled. The caves themselves were a series of commodious open galleries that ran with the exposed strata. They were ideal for habitation by primitive man, located high up the slope and protected from the prevailing winds, yet with a wide view out across the plain onto which the kloof debouched. They were close to water and readily defensible against all marauders, and the depth of the midden and accumulated detritus on the floor of the caves attested to the ages over which they had been occupied. The roofs of the caves were darkened with the smoke of countless cooking fires, and the inner walls were decorated with the engravings and childlike paintings of the ancient San peoples and their predecessors, all the signs of a major site with the presence of very early hominids were evident. And although the dig was still in its early stages and they had penetrated only the upper levels, spirits and optimism were high, and the whole feeling on the dig was of a close-knit community of persons bound by a common interest, cooperating selflessly on a project of outstanding importance. Tara particularly liked Marion Hurst, the American professor in charge of the excavations. She was a woman in her early 50s, with cropped grey hair and a skin burned to the colour and consistency of saddle leather by the suns of Arabia and Africa. They had become firm friends even before Tara discovered that she was married to a Negro professor of anthropology at Cornell. That knowledge made their relationship secure and relieved Tara of the necessity of any subterfuge. One night she sat late with Marion in the shed they were using as a laboratory, and suddenly Tara found herself telling her about Moses Gama and her impossible love, even about the child she was carrying. The elder woman's sympathy was immediate and sincere. What iniquitous social order can keep people from loving others? Of course I knew all about these laws before I came here. That is why Tom stayed at home. Despite my personal feelings, the work here was just too important to pass up. However, you have my promise that I will do anything in my power to help the two of you. Yet Tara had been on the dig for 5 weeks without having heard from Moses Gama. She had written him a dozen letters and telephoned the Rivonia number, and the other number in Drake's Farms township. Moses was never there, and never responded to her urgent messages. At last she could stand it no longer, and she borrowed Marion's pickup truck and went into the city, almost an hour's drive with the first half of the journey, over clay roads that were rutted and bumpy, and finally over wide black-topped highways in a solid stream of heavy traffic, coming up from the coalfields at Witbank. She parked the pickup under the blue gum trees at the back of Puck's Hill, and was suddenly afraid to see him again, terrified that it had all changed, and he would send her away. It took all her courage to leave the cab of the pickup and go around the big unkempt house to the front veranda. At the far end, there was a man sitting at the desk, and her heart soared and then as swiftly plunged as he turned and saw her and stood up. It was Marcus Archer. He came down the long veranda towards her, and his smile was spiteful and vinegary. "Surprise," he said. The last person I expected to see. Hello, Marcus. I was looking for Moses. I know you're looking for, dearie. Is he here? Marcus shook his head. I haven't seen him for almost 2 weeks. I have written and telephoned. He doesn't reply. I was worried. Perhaps he doesn't reply because he doesn't want to see you. Why do you dislike me so, Marcus? Oh, my dear. Whatever gave you that idea? Marcus smiled archly. I'm sorry to have bothered you. She began to turn away and then paused, her expression hardened. Will you give him a message when you see him? Marcus inclined his head, and for the first time she noticed the grey hairs in his ginger sideburns and the wrinkles in the corners of his eyes. He was much older than she had thought. Will you tell Moses that I came to find him, and that nothing has changed, that I meant every word I said? Very well, dearie, I'll tell him. Tara went down the steps, but when she reached the bottom, he called after her. Tara! And she looked up. He leaned on the railing of the veranda. You'll never have him. You know that, don't you? He will keep you only as long as he needs you. Then he will cast you aside. He will never belong to you. Nor to you either, Marcus Archer, she said softly, and he recoiled from her. He belongs to neither of us. He belongs to Africa and his people. And she saw the desolation in his eyes. It gave her no satisfaction, and she went slowly back to the pickup and drove away. At level 6 in the main gallery of the Sundi Caves, they exposed an extensive deposit of clay pottery fragments. There were no intact artefacts, and it was obviously a dumping site for the ancient potters. Nevertheless, the discovery was of crucial importance in dating the levels, for the pottery was of a very early type. Marian Hurst was excited by the find and transmitted her excitement to all of them. By this time, Tara had been promoted from the heavy work of grubbing in the dirt at the bottom of the trenches. She had displayed a natural aptitude for the puzzle game of fitting the fragments of bone and pottery together in their original form. And she now worked in the long, prefabricated shed under Marian Hurst's direct supervision, and was making herself an invaluable member of the team. Tara found that while she was absorbed with the fragments, she could suppress the ache of longing and the turmoil of uncertainty and guilt. She knew that her neglect of her children and her family was unforgivable. Once a week she telephoned Rhodes Hill and spoke to her father and Santin and to Isabella. The child seemed quite content, and in a strangely selfish way Tara resented the fact that she seemed not to pine for her mother, but was accepting her grandmother as a happy substitute. Santin was friendly and made no criticism of her continued absence. But Blaine Malcolm-S, her beloved father, was as usual bluntly outspoken. I don't know what you're trying to run away from, Tara, but believe me, it never works. Your place is here with your husband and your children. Enough of this nonsense now. You know your duty. However unpleasant you may find it, it's still your duty. Of course, Shaza and the boys would soon be returning from their grand safari, and then she could procrastinate no longer. She would have to make a decision, and she was not even certain of the alternatives. Sometimes in the night, in those silent small hours, when human energy and spirits are at their lowest ebb, she even considered following Molly's advice and aborting the child from her womb and turning her back on Moses, going back to the seductive and destructively soft life of Velta Frieden. Oh, Moses, if only I could see you again, just to speak to you for a few hours. Then I would know what to do. She found herself withdrawing from the company of the other workers on the excavation. The cheerful, carefree attitude of the two university students she shared her tent with began to irritate her. Their conversation was so naive and childlike. Even the music they played endlessly on a portable tape recorder was so loud and uncouth that it rasped on her nerves. With Marian's blessing, she purchased a small bell tent of her own and erected it near the laboratory where she worked, so that when the others took their noonday siesta, she could slip back to her workbench and forget all her insoluble problems in the totally absorbing task of fitting together the shattered scraps. Their antiquity seemed to soothe her and make the problems of the present seem trivial and unimportant. It was here, at her bench, in the middle of a hot, somnolent, high-felt afternoon, that the light from the open doorway was blocked suddenly, and she looked up, frowning, wiping back the sweaty wisps of hair from her forehead with the back of her hand, and then her mouth went dry, and her heart seemed to freeze for a long moment, and then race wildly. The sunlight was behind him, so his was a tall silhouette, broad-shouldered, slim-hipped, and regal. She sobbed and sprang up from the bench and flew to him, wrapping her arms around his chest and pressing her face to his heart so that she could feel it beat against her cheek. She could not speak, and his voice was deep and gentle above her. "I have been cruel to you. I should have come to you sooner." "No," she whispered, "it doesn't matter. Now that you are here, nothing else matters." He stayed only one night, and Marion Hurst protected them from the other members of the expedition, so that they were alone in her small tent, isolated from the world and its turmoil. Tara did not sleep that night. Each moment was far too precious to waste. In the dawn he said to her, "I must go again soon. There is something that you must do for me." "Anything," she whispered. "Our campaign of defiance begins soon. There will be terrible risk and sacrifice for thousands of our people. But for their sacrifice to be worthwhile, it must be brought to the attention of the world." "What can I do?" she asked. "By a most fortunate coincidence, there is an American television team in the country at this very moment. They are making a series called Africa on Focus." "Yes, I know about them. They interviewed..." She broke off. She didn't want to mention Shazan. Not now. Not during this treasured interlude. "They interviewed your husband," he finished for her. "Yes, I know. However, they have almost finished filming, and I have heard that they plan to return to the United States within the next few days. We need them here. We need them to film and record our struggle. They must show it to the world. The spirit of our people, the indomitable will to rise above oppression and inhumanity." "How can I help?" "I cannot reach the producer of this series on my own. I need a go-between. You have to prevent them leaving. We have to make certain they are here to film the defiance when it begins. You must speak to the woman in charge of the filming. Her name is Godolphin, Kitty Godolphin, and she will be staying at the Sunnyside Hotel in Johannesburg for the next 3 days." "I will go to her today. Tell her that the time is not yet agreed, but when it is, I will let her know, and she must be there with her camera." "I'll see that she is," Tara promised, and he rolled her gently onto her back and made love to her again. It seemed impossible, but for Tara every time was better than the last, and when he left her and rose from the camp bed, she felt weak and soft and warm as molten wax. "Moses," she said softly, and he paused in buttoning the pale blue open-neck shirt. "What is it?" he asked softly. She had to tell him about the child she was carrying. She sat up, letting the rumpled sheet fall to her waist, and her breasts, already heavy with her pregnancy, were dappled with tiny blue veins beneath the ivory smooth skin. "Moses," she repeated stupidly, trying to find the courage to say it. And he came to her. "Tell me," he commanded, and her courage failed her. She could not tell him. The risk that it would drive him away was too great. I just wanted to tell you how grateful I am that you have given me this opportunity to be of service to the struggle." It was much easier to contact Kitty Godolphin than she had expected it to be. She borrowed Marion's pickup and drove 5 miles to the nearest village, and she telephoned from the public booth in the little single-roomed post office. The operator in the Sunnyside Hotel put her through to the room, and a firm young voice with a Louisiana lilt said, "Kitty Godolphin, who is this, please?" "I'd rather not give you my name, Miss Godolphin, but I'd like to meet you as soon as possible. I have a story for you, an important and dramatic story." "When and where do you want to meet?" "It'll take me 2 hours to reach your hotel." "I'll be waiting for you," said Kitty Godolphin, and it was easy as that. Tara checked with reception, and the girl at the desk phoned through to Miss Godolphin's suite, and then told her to go up. A young girl, slim and pretty, in a tartan shirt and blue jeans, opened the door to Tara's ring. Hello, is Miss Godolphin in? She's expecting me. The girl looked her over carefully, taking in her khaki bush skirt and mosquito boots, her tanned arms and face, and the scarf tied around her thick auburn hair. I'm Kitty Godolphin, said the girl, and Tara could not hide her surprise. Okay, don't tell me. You expected an old bag. Come on in and tell me who you are. In the lounge, Tara removed her sunglasses and faced her. My name is Tara Courtney. I understand you know my husband, Shasa Courtney, chairman of Courtney Mining and Finance. She saw the shift in the other woman's expression and the sudden hard gleam in those eyes that she had thought were frank and innocent. I meet a lot of people in my business, Mrs. Courtney. Tara had not expected the hostility, and hurriedly she tried to forestall it. I'm sure you do. Did you want to talk to me about your husband, lady? I don't have a lot of time to waste. Kitty looked pointedly at her wristwatch. It was a man's Rolex, and she wore it on the inside of her wrist, like a soldier. No, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to give you that impression. I've come here on behalf of someone else, someone who is unable to come to you himself. Why not? Kitty asked sharply, and Tara readjusted her early estimate of her. Despite her childlike appearance, she was as tough and sharp as any man Tara had ever met. Because he is being watched by the police special branch, and because what he is planning is dangerous and illegal. Tara saw instantly that she had said the right things, and had aroused the newspaper woman's instinct. Sit down, Mrs. Courtney. Do you want some coffee? She picked up the house phone and ordered from room service, then turned back to Tara. Now tell me, who is this mysterious person? You've probably never heard of him, but soon the whole world will know his name, Tara said. It's Moses Garmer. Moses Garmer? Hell, Kitty Godolphin exclaimed. For 6 weeks now I've been trying to catch up with him. I was beginning to think he was just a rumor, that he didn't really exist. A Scarlet Pimpernel. He exists, Tara assured her. Can you get me an interview with him? Kitty demanded, so anxious that she leaned across and grasped Tara's wrist impulsively. He's an Emmy score, that one. He is the one person in South Africa I really want to talk to. I can do a whole lot better than that, Tara promised her.